This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
If you're waiting, we tend to sometimes adopt a simplistic approach to the baddies in the Torah. And we tend to picture them in our minds in the same way that we pictured them when we were little children. And in the same way that they're pictured in Bible stories and so on. We never really grow out of that. If we learn the psukim as they're written, and certainly with the Mefoshim and with Chazal, we realize that things aren't that simplistic at all. Who was Korach? Firstly, Korach was one of the people who came out of Egypt and lived with the community of Israel during that period. So already we know he's somebody of exceptional stature, because that whole generation was exceptional. There was nobody ordinary among that whole group of people. So even if he rated somewhere low down in the hierarchy, he was still a very exceptional person. But he wasn't just an ordinary person, he was of the leadership. And very close to the absolute top rungs of leadership. So Korach was a man that wasn't in potential far off from being a Moshe Rabbein. He was a man of great ability, great wisdom, great knowledge, and probably great character too. Sometimes people crack. But the fact that he cracked, and that the Torah focuses on the crack for the purpose of this parsha, mustn't distort our vision of who the man was in his entirety. But not only that, let's have a look at the crack and see what was so terrible. What did Korach do that was so terrible? He got together a crowd of people, 250. And who were those 250? Nasi'ei Edo, Kiriyei Moed, Anshei Shem. They were princes of the community, people who used to who led, who were always central to any leadership decision. Anshei Shem, people of great reputation. So not only was Korach himself a man of considerable stature, but the team that he gathered around him, the 250 people, were of the cream of the community. And they gathered up against Moshe and against Aaron. And they said to them, "You've got too much. That's all. Everybody here has sanctity. We're all great people. And Hashem is in the midst of all of us. Why have you taken so much for yourselves? Moshe, you're the king. Aaron, you're the Kohen Gadol. You're the high priest. Why have you taken the two brothers? Why have you taken so much? When there is so much talent, when there's so much ability, when there's so much sanctity among the people, why haven't you split up the functions a little bit more evenly and a little bit more equally to make sure that everybody gets involved in some way?" Not an unreasonable statement. There might be answers to it, but the statement in itself is not unreasonable. Didn't Yisro say something similar to Moshe? "Why are you doing it all by yourself? Why are you the only judge? Do you think nobody else has the ability? Appoint judges beneath you. There are many people who have the talent and the ability to take the decisions that you're taking. You don't have to do it all by yourself." That was accepted. Yisroel didn't become a villain because of that. So far Korach is coming with a legitimate claim. Vayishma Moshe vayipol aponav. Moshe hears, he falls on his face, he gets into a state. And then he appeals to Korach and he says, "In the morning we'll sort it out." And there's the whole story of the 250 men taking these machtos, and they get killed in the process. And again, so it goes on. Dosan Aviram climb in. They also say, "Look, you promised us to take us to a land of milk and honey. You haven't done that. You haven't delivered. What kind of a leader are you?" Moshe gets very angry. What was it that they did that was so bad? We shouldn't develop the feeling from this that the Torah is intolerant of the questioning of leadership. That would be a very dangerous conclusion to draw from the parsha. It's a very popular conclusion to draw from the parsha. that one can't question leadership. But it's not a very healthy conclusion to draw from the parasha. Nowadays, the emphasis is being placed so much on obedience rather than on innovation, rather than on originality, rather than on creativity. Obedience. The Gedolim say, that's it. Who were the Gedolim? What exactly did they say? Why did they say it? Who did they address it to? What was the underlying meaning of what they said? That you don't hear people questioning that. That's questioning. Who are you to question? They said it. That's it. And if a person starts questioning, he doesn't stand a chance. And we've discussed often that there are two types of questioning, and the English word question is an interesting word to use, because one can question and one can question. You can say something and I can say, I would like to question you on that. That means I don't understand you and I have some questions I would like to pose. And there's another way I can say it, is I can say, I can question what you say, which means I dispute your authority and competence to make the comments you've made. I'm not asking questions, I'm disputing the authority. And we tend to mix those two understandings of the word question up. When people of great authority and great knowledge, great competence and great experience make statements, we're not permitted to question them in the sense of, I doubt the validity of what you're saying. But we are expected to question them in the sense of, I need to understand it. It's all very well that you're making a statement, but I need to understand it. I need to have a feel for it. I need to integrate it. And I can't integrate it if I don't understand it. And today we're finding ourselves, and it's not only among religious Jews, it bothers us most amongst religious Jews because it stifles creativity there. One finds it all over. One finds it in all religions at the moment. One finds it in secular society as well. A tendency to relate to things in such a superficial slogan way. The slogan is pronounced, and now I've just got to decide whether I accept or I don't accept. Do I belong to the group that accepts the slogan, or don't I belong to the group that accepts that slogan? That's all. Nobody actually takes the slogans and says, get them out of the way, and let's intellectually understand what's the meaning of that statement, where does it originate from, and what is the principle on which it's founded, and when I've questioned that, I'll be able to work out my position. Or even to say differently, to say, I do accept it because it comes from a source that I respect. That's not the issue of accepting it, but I want to do much more than accept it. I want to understand it, I want to integrate it, I want to question it, not doubt it, but question it in order to analyze it so that I can integrate it and so that I can absorb it. We've often talked about the Naaseh v'Nishma that the Jewish people were praised for saying when they accepted the Torah. Naaseh, we will do, v'Nishma, and we will listen. But they first said Naaseh, first they said we'll do, we accept. Then they said v'Nishma, we'll hear. And I've often explained that v'nishma, the second, we will hear, does not mean we will then hear what you want us to do. We accept and then we will do. They didn't say we accept and then we will do. They said, no, I say we will do. In order to do, you have to have heard already what you have to do. So really they're saying three things. Nishma, naaseh, v'nishma. We will hear what to do, we'll do it, and we'll hear. It's not just two statements. Naaseh implies two steps. We shall do, we shall obey, implies two steps. We shall listen to you, hear what you want us to do, number one. Number two, we shall do it. So what's the third step then? You've heard, you know what God wants, you did it. Now what's the third step? The third step is the most important one. It's the one we've deleted from our experience today. Having heard what you want me to do, and having done what you want me to do, that's not the end of the process, that's just the beginning. Now starts the process of nishma. I'm going to listen, I want to hear the inside, I want to understand it. I want to perceive the depths of what you've asked me to do and what I'm quite willing to do. But not like a monkey. I want to understand what I'm doing. That's the Jewish challenge to God. Naaseh v'nishma wasn't a blind obedience. Why did God get so thrilled? Because we said, yeah, sure, we'll do whatever you want to do, we'll do. Is that going to make a God excited? A Ribono Shel Olam is going to get all excited if everybody says, Yabas, Yabas, whatever you want, I'll do, not to worry. Yeah, tell me to do and I'll do it. I'm a robot, I'm a machine, I'm a monkey. That wouldn't excite the Ribono Shel Olam. When the Ribono Shel Olam says, Mi gilo razeh labonai, who taught them this? Where did they get this from? He was thrilled, the Ribono Shel Olam. God got so excited. What was the source of excitement? Not their obedience. And obedience, remember what Chazal tell us. How did he get the obedience? He held the mountain over us. And he said, look, it's free choice. You accept the Torah, that's fine. You don't accept the Torah, you're going to be buried right here and now. I'm dropping the mountain, my hand's getting tired. Make up your minds. You take as long as you want to, but I must warn you, my hand's getting tired now, and I'm running out of time, And when I get too tired, I'm going to drop it. Now, if you want to accept the Torah, is that the obedience that God got all excited about? And then said, who taught my children the secret? What secret? What he was so excited about wasn't the obedience. The obedience we were forced into. We had no choice but to say, nah, say, of course we'll do. What's our choice? Get buried under the mountain? But we didn't just say we'll do. We said, and doing it, having accepted upon ourselves to follow the Torah, Nishma, we're going to start an exciting intellectual process to understand the Torah. And that got God excited. That made him thrilled. That's the Jewish challenge to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the Jewish challenge to God and to ourselves. So what's Korach doing so terrible? He's challenging. That's all. And as I say, the popular way of understanding this is, wicked Korach challenging Moshe. Gedolim say, what right has he got to question? That's not the pshat. That's not what it means. God gave us the facility to question because he wants us to question. He wants us to analyze. He wants us to understand. The only thing is, our actions are not conditional to our understanding. Because if our actions are conditional to our understanding, we will never understand what we don't want to act out. We will never achieve intellectual integrity if our actions are conditional to our understanding. It's necessary to make our actions unconditional. But there's a separate thing. We will unconditionally accept the Torah, but quite apart from that, we will also seek endlessly to understand every facet and every aspect of the Torah until it makes rational sense to us. That's our mission. That's what we've charged ourselves to do. So what's Korach doing so terrible? He's challenging. It's true, if Korach was living in 1993 in Bnei Brak or Yerushalayim, we would understand that he would be a Rosha because he's challenging authority. But he didn't live then. He lived a long time ago when challenging authority was okay if it was done for the right reason. And that's where we find the problem with Korach. The Mishnah says there are two types of arguments that took place. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos in the 5th Perek. One example of a machlokes was Hillel and Shammai. And another example was Korach and the community. Hillel and Shammai's argument was a kosher argument because it was L'shem Shammayim. Korach's argument was not a kosher argument because it was not L'shem Shammayim. In other words, the Mishnah finds one flaw in Korach, and that is a lack of sincerity. This wasn't constructive, that's all. There's nothing wrong with challenging, there's nothing wrong with questioning. What has to be understood is the motivation of the questioning. Is the motivation to destroy or is it to construct? And that's the only criticism that we find in Chazal of what Korach did. The machlokes itself, the dispute itself, is not criticized. It's the intention of the dispute, the motivation behind the dispute. That's what's criticized. So in our picturing, in our mind's picture of Korach, we must be very careful not to stereotype him into some kind of, I don't know, what we would, how one would picture old Korach. And I'm sure people see him in all sorts of different forms and guises. The one form and guise that people don't see him is the way he probably looked. And certainly would look if he lived today. He would have a very, very long beard and a very, very big black hat with a very long black coat. And he would be sitting in his Beis HaMedrash all day. He was a rov of a community, highly thought of, giving shiurim all day, with sforim all around him. Don't think of him as a fiddler at the stock exchange. A fiddler, I don't mean a violin player. You've got to think of him as a Talmid Chacham. He was a rov, he was a rabbi, a Talmid Chacham. That's who he was, and very much a part of it. And the whole dispute arose out of his motivation and his intention. Let's go a step further. Last night we learnt an interesting medrash where God says, God's already fed up now, this is enough, and he's ready to destroy them. And he instructs Moshe and says, talk to the community and tell them, hey, olu misolviv l'mishkan Korach dosun v'aviru. Remove yourselves from around the territory of the dwelling place of Korach and Dosol and Avirum, those three families. And in the next sentence, Moshe does not do what God tells him. He does not go and tell the people to move off. He first does something else. Vayokom Moshe got up. Vayelech el Dosol v'Avirum. He walked over to the troublemakers. And there's forim that actually calculate the distance he had to walk. It was a good few kilometers. It wasn't just a matter of going from his office across the corridor to stick his head into Dosol and Aviram's office. He had to walk. Imagine the humiliation. Imagine the tension. The whole community is now divided into two camps, and people aren't sure who's right. Korach is not much lower in stature and in reputation than Moshe is himself. The media are backing Korach. They're making some nasty comments and rumors about Moshe and Aaron. There are a lot of people who believe that Korach is right and Moshe is wrong. There are a lot of people who believe that Moshe might be wrong. They're not quite sure. And this is all going to be sorted out quite soon. They all believe in God. And they all believe that God is going to sort this out miraculously and somebody is going to be blown to pieces. The question is, who's the fraud? Who's the man who's presenting himself as something that he isn't? Who's the one who's going to be destroyed? So there must have been an incredible feeling of tension. And Moshe has tried over and over again to appeal to the reason of Korach and his group of people unsuccessfully. And now Moshe leaves his tent, leaves his Beis HaMedrash, and undertakes a walk of several kilometers through these hostile people, some of them hostile, others curious. Step by step he walks to the tents of Dothan v'Aviram. What's going to happen there? There is a small chance that they're going to say, gee, Moshe, if you've come all this way, we hand it to you. Let's sit down and let's talk. Let's make peace. It's a small chance. And that's why Moshe did it. But more likely, Moshe is going to be humiliated. They've humiliated him time and time again. More likely, he's going to be humiliated. So here you've got the king walking over to these troublemakers in the knowledge that the chances are that he's going to be humiliated. And that's what happens. He does get humiliated and he says, well, now I've done my bit. And the Medrash asked, in the Medrash, piece of Medrash that we did last night, why does the Torah tell us this? If the exercise failed, why is it so important to tell us this? And the Medrash says, Lohidia Rish Oson, to teach us how wicked they were. But Moshe came over and they didn't receive him nicely. They slammed the door in his face. Teach us how wicked they were. Which introduces us into an understanding of what wickedness is, which is another shift that we need to make. We sometimes think different people again have different ideas of what wickedness is. If you ask a little child what's wicked, he'll say to kill people is wicked. That's his picture of wickedness. Aggression and violence he associates with wickedness. Maybe nowadays if he's a television watching kid, he doesn't associate violence with wickedness anymore. I don't know what wickedness is to children nowadays. That's what used to be wicked. A picture of violent aggression would be wickedness. If you ask a religious Jew what's wicked, somebody doesn't listen to the Gedolim, somebody doesn't keep Shabbos, he's got his picture of what's wicked. Let's see what really is wicked. So Chazal tell us, Dalid Nikru Roshoim. There are four types of people who are called wicked. Now this is not the only definition of wicked. There are the word Rosho, and wicked is not a good translation for Rosho, because Rosho is a wide term that has different halachic ramifications. But the kind of wickedness we're talking about here is based on our understanding last night, where we said there are times that you have to condemn an action, but it's seldom that you condemn a person. That doesn't mean that you don't punish people. We punish people not because we condemn them. We punish people because we value them. A person that you don't value, you don't bother punishing. So when a parent punishes a child, that's not because he's condemning the child. That's because he values the child. When the teacher punishes a student, that's not because he's condemning the student. He values the student. So punishment is not an expression of condemnation, or not necessarily an expression of condemnation. Condemnation is when you write the person off. That's condemnation. And there are different ways of writing people off. One is totally destroying them. There are different ways. I'm sure I've told you how in the... when I was first in yeshiva, it was a terrible experience for me, because here at school, at least when it came to Gemara studies, I was the best in the class. And by the time I was in the trick, I was the best in the school. And there weren't that many people my age learning Gemara in Johannesburg in those days. So for my age, I was probably one of the best in the town. It was a nice feeling. I got to yeshiva and found there was nobody in the entire yeshiva that knew as little as I did, which was quite a shock. And it reminded me of a professor of mathematics from Harvard, a Yoreh Shemayim, a very fine man, a big Talmid Chochem, and he had a class of 50 students every year. From each state, he got one student, either the best or the second best. If he got the second best, then the best went to Yale. If the second best went to Yale, he got the best. So from every state, they accepted one student who was either first or second in the entire state in mathematics. And he was telling me once about the enormous psychological problems that the people at the bottom of the class were experiencing. Imagine from coming from being the best in the state to being the worst in the class. And I felt with him that time when I got to yeshiva. Anyway, it was very, very frustrating getting to listen to a shiur. You don't understand one word, not one word of a shiur. And that's how that was my introduction to yeshiva. Anyway, things started improving, and I was sitting in the shiur, and I used to sit right next to the Rosh Yeshiva, who was a very tough fellow in the early days. And I remember for the first time, I'll never forget that, plucking up the courage to ask a question. Because he was ruthless if the question was useless. Absolutely ruthless. If you asked a bad question, it happened once. It never, ever happened again. In fact, the chances were you never asked a question again. And I asked the question, and as I completed the question, it suddenly struck me what an idiotic, stupid question it was. And if there was any way to disappear, to drop dead, to anything, I would have done anything that I could possibly have done just to avoid what was about to come. And I just froze. I will never forget the feeling. And he turned around, because I was sitting right on his right hand side, and he took his Gemara and he held it in front of me like this, and he learned through a piece with me as if I was the only person in the class, spent about 10 minutes on the question, and helped me through it in a way that left my dignity totally intact. So I thought, now this is very interesting. And I went to him afterwards and I said, I'm very concerned because I've noticed something. The shiur is divided into three categories. There are some who are exceptionally good, there are some who are totally useless, and there are some who are in the middle somewhere. And I've noticed when somebody good asks a bad question, you destroy them. When a middle guy puts up his hand, you don't even let him ask a question. And when one of the idiots asks a question, you're terribly polite. I said, I asked the question today and you were jolly polite. And I resent that. And that was the beginning of one of the most important relationships in my life, and a very wonderful relationship. But we've got to be careful how we condemn, or how we don't condemn. And when a teacher punishes, one of the ways of condemning sometimes is ignoring a person. You just don't count, you're not important enough to even answer the question. Another way of condemning is to be very polite. The English developed this wonderful ability to be extremely polite to the people they condemn. It's just a way of getting on with people you don't like without really disrupting the passages of social intercourse. There are different ways. Each society and each civilization develops its own way of condemning people. With God, there's no messing around. When he condemns somebody, he gets rid of them, as he did with Korach. So when we talk about the term Rosho here, we're talking about a particular kind of Rosho, that is a wicked person, not whose deeds are deserving of condemnation, but whose person is deserving of condemnation. That's what the Medrash is going to define for us. Four types of people whose person is deserving of condemnation. Who are they? The first one is Haposheit Yodoi Lechavero Lahakoiso Afal Pishlo Yiko Nikro Rosho. If a person raises his hand against his friend, even though he doesn't touch him, he just raises his hand, that's a Rosho. There the person is deserving of condemnation. Forget about the action. The action's not so serious. What's the action? He didn't hurt anybody. If he would have hurt him, then the action would have been deserving of condemnation. Yeah, the action is not so serious, but the person is condemned. He's a Rosho. That's number one. The next one. Haloyver ve'eno meshalim, people who don't pay their accounts. Another Rosho. Person who owes money and doesn't pay up. A Rosho. Third one. Mishiyesh boi azusponim ve'eno misbayesh lifnei misha godol himen. A person who is, difficult word to translate, probably cheeky, arrogant, and doesn't feel embarrassed before somebody who's greater than him. He opens his mouth out of place, he talks out of place. He doesn't feel when he's in the presence of somebody greater than him. And the third one, Umishuhu Baal Machlokes. Third one is one who creates machlokas, one who creates division among people, one who creates dissension among people. Those are the four. Doesn't mention a person who doesn't keep Shabbos, doesn't mention a person who doesn't keep kashrus, doesn't mention a person who doesn't go to shul on Yom Kippur, or a person who doesn't fast on Yom Kippur. Those are not people to condemn. Those are people who are doing things they ought not to be doing. That's all. That doesn't make them people worthy of condemnation. People worthy of condemnation are people who show physical aggression even though they don't actually express it. People who don't feel uncomfortable with indebtedness. People who don't feel the limitations of their own personalities and intellect in the presence of greater people than them. And people who cause divisiveness. And let's have a look at these four. It would appear as we go through them that these are people who are placing unnecessary, or people who are removing barriers between themselves and others. There's a certain barrier between people that make it unacceptable behavior to act aggressively. It's just not acceptable. This person doesn't realize that limitation on behavior. There is a barrier between a borrower and a lender, between a creditor and a debtor. There's a certain kind of behavior that is required of a debtor to his creditor. This person doesn't relate to that at all. When you're in the presence of somebody greater than you, there's a certain barrier, there's a certain manner of how to act, of how to behave, certain courtesies. This person is not cognizant of it at all. What doesn't fit into that classification is the fourth one, because he's doing the opposite. He's creating barriers where there shouldn't be any. He's taking people who are supposed to be getting on well together and he's dividing them. So let us try and understand a little bit more about these four people. Starting with the fourth one, what is the essence of the fourth one? And here I'm going to slightly modify something that I've previously said. The origin of machlokes, the origin of divisiveness, was long before there were people in the world, strangely enough. It was on the second day of creation. On all the days of creation, it says, and God saw what he had created, and it was very good. With one exception, on the second day, there's no mention of it being very good. Which clearly implies to us that God's perception, his own perception, of his creation of the second day, fell short of the ideal. Difficult to understand how God would create something that falls short of the ideal. But it's the only day that God doesn't look at it and say, that's nice, what we did today was good. He doesn't feel that satisfaction. He looks at his work that day, but he doesn't feel the satisfaction that he's done a good job, that he's made something worthwhile. So there's obviously something negative. What is it? And the Medrash brings two views. The one is Shabo Nivro Gehenim. That's the day that Gehenim was created, hell was created. It's necessary to create it. But it spoils the beauty of the creation, and that's why God didn't comment about the beauty of it and the perfection of it. Rabbi Chanina says, Sheboi Nivro Machlokes. That's the day on which the power to be divisive was created. The power, so we see that that's a force in the world. That divisiveness is a force, it's an energy that was sourced. That second day of creation, it's not just something that people create. There could have been such a binding force in the world that divisiveness would not be possible. Could have been possible. God could, had he wanted to, he could have structured the world and society in such a way that you can't divide it. It's too strong. But he didn't. He allowed for the possibility of divisiveness, and he made that provision on the second day. Where do we see that? Shenemar vayehi mavdil bein mayim lemayim. Because it says, and God separated between the water and the water. Some water he kept down below, some water he put above. However we understand that, whether he's talking about water vapor and water, whether he's talking about clouds and water, whether he's talking about some spiritual concept of water against the material concept, it's not very clear, not very easy to understand what exactly it means. But it does mean that the concept of water was divided into two different concepts. One was water as we know it in the sea, and the other was water in a more spiritual and a much finer form, which he divided with a rakia that he'd formed. They translate the rakia as the sky. I don't know whether that's an accurate translation or not, but he formed some sort of division below which he had water and above which he had water. And I've often made the point that what the essence of this machlokes is, this divisiveness, is that he differentiated between mayim lemayim, between water and water. To differentiate between hydrogen and oxygen, that's not machlokes. That's havchono, that's discernment. We have to be able to see the differences and to separate things that are separate. We can combine them in all sorts of composites, that's fine. But we need to be able to retain their separate identity too, and sometimes we cannot combine them. And so we cannot mix milk and meat. And so we cannot mix linen and wool in the same garment. There are certain things we can't mix. We cannot graft trees of different species. But even when we can mix them, we're meant to be able to retain the ability to discern and distinguish between different species and between different elements. But Vayehi Mavil Ben Mayim LeMayim, that this thing, whatever it was, separated between water and water, that's Machlokes. To take the same thing and split it into two, to take one thing and split it into two, that's divisiveness. And the potential for that kind of divisiveness was created on that second day. But I want to review that very slightly and say the word machlokes doesn't indicate that. The word machlokes comes from the word chelek, which means portion. And that means, machlokes means to divide things up into their constituents, which makes it a little bit more difficult to understand why then it's so negative. To divide one object that is meant to be one, to divide that up into two, I can understand. And that's how we've defined machlokes up until now. But now I'm saying, no, the word machlokes doesn't quite indicate that. The word machlokes seems to suggest that you divide something into its chalokim, into its divisive parts. So you're taking one object that is made up of separate sections and you're separating the sections. Why is that so negative and so destructive? And if that is our understanding of machlokes, the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos is easier to understand. That is, machlokes per se is not negative. Hillel and Shammai had machlokes. There was great divisiveness between Hillel and Shammai. But it was okay, it was acceptable, it was dynamic, it was productive. Korach, not in order, not okay. It's not the machlokes that is the problem. That's what we started off saying when I said to you that Rabbi Yeruchim points out that there's nothing he did wrong. Questioning, challenging authority, that's not wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. If it's l'shem Shammayim, if it's meant for good cause. So the machlokes as such, merely differentiating, and God did that on the second day, so we can't say it was bad. He wouldn't have done something bad. To break something up into its constituent parts is per se not negative. There needs to be an understanding of the motivation behind the breaking up. Because when you break something up into its parts, different things can happen. Let's try and understand what can happen. There's a wonderful book that's just been written, recently, called The Fifth Discipline. You don't need to read the whole book, but you do need to read the first three pages. And don't think that it's a waste of money. It's an expensive book. Don't think that it's a waste of money to buy just for the first three pages. It isn't a waste of money to buy just for the first three pages. In fact, recent research has shown that most of these business books, I don't know if it applies to all books, but certainly to these business books, very few people ever finish. They put out these circulation figures that they've sold 2 million copies, 5 million copies, but somebody then got the idea, let's check how many copies were read. And very few are actually read, very, very few. And certainly beyond page 20, page 50, page 80, that's about as far as people tend to go. And this is one of those books where, I'm not saying that the rest of it is not worthwhile reading, but what you need to read is right at the very beginning. And his whole theory of understanding businesses revolves around an image that he uses at the beginning, which is, we've been taught, in the way we've been educated, of course, the author, Peter Seng, didn't go to yeshiva. So he has been taught that in order to understand something, you've got to break it down into its constituent parts. You can't begin to understand something until you break it down, until you analyze it. He says, that's very fine. But when you try and put it together again, sometimes it's a little hard. And he says, it's like breaking a mirror into thousands of pieces, and then putting the pieces together and looking at yourself in the mirror and saying, oh, now it's a mirror again, I can see myself. It's not a mirror again. There's still little pieces, and you haven't succeeded in putting it together again. And so he talks about the danger of disintegrating knowledge in order to understand it, when that disintegrating process sometimes deprives you of the ability of being able to see it holistically again. Which is a very interesting approach and challenges traditional methods of education and traditional methods of thinking in the secular world. And that's what machlokes is, isn't it? Breaking things into its constituent parts. Sometimes a very positive process, and sometimes a very negative process. Sometimes it's something that needs to be done, and sometimes it mustn't be done. How do we go about it? When do we know when to do it and when not to do it? And what is the danger? The danger is that you begin to analyze the parts without any kind of understanding and full perception of the way the parts interrelate. That you start seeing each part separately, and even when you try to put them together again, it's too late. And that applies even more so when you realize that the things that we're analyzing are seldom static. They're not objects. Even his mirror image isn't a good image. A better image would say you take a tree apart, break it into all its different branches, and plant them, and let them carry on growing, and then try and put it together again like the original tree. Each one's gone growing. Some have died, some haven't been successful, some have blossomed, some haven't blossomed. Now you put it together into one tree again. We're dealing with something dynamic and moving. You can't take something dynamic apart. Take the human being apart because you want to study him. Imagine that they decided to take the human being apart. Doctors haven't got there yet. In medical schools, they haven't got there yet to decide. Take a living human being apart. Why do a post-mortem on a dead person? Let's do it on a living person. That sounds absurd, doesn't it? But isn't that what the psychologists and the psychiatrists do all the time? Take him apart, look at this part of him, look at that part of him, look at that angle, look at that angle. It doesn't work. Because unless you see the entire interrelationship, you're not looking at a living organism. And you can only study it while it's living. And so we have a very challenging function. We have to be able to take things apart and yet in a way that doesn't destroy their integrity. That's what the art of machlokes is. The ability to separate and to discern and to see the different elements in a way that doesn't disturb its integrity. And that's what we've got to question with Korach. That he wanted to take the community apart, fine. Yisroel did the same. He restructured the community. He took Moshe apart, he took the legal system apart, he took the rabbinic system apart, and he restructured it in a most brilliant way. And he's given great credit for that. All Korach wants to do is also, he wants to take the community apart and restructure it. What he doesn't realize is that after he's taken it apart, it won't be able to be restructured. That's what one has to understand. Sometimes you can take something apart so far that you can't put it together again. Sometimes you have to take people apart. Sometimes you've got to break them open. Sometimes you've got to let them see the pieces too. And you've got to be very careful that you can put the person together again. Because sometimes the process of taking them apart is such that you can never put them together again. We find that happening in the Baal Tshuva movement. We've discussed it often here. That the process of becoming religious has to also be a dynamic process. And yes, sometimes it does need a bit of taking the past apart. But one has to be very careful that one doesn't take it apart in a way that you can't put it together again, and that somehow you've started a new life at age 20, 30 or 40 or whenever it is that you start, and everything else that before somehow doesn't feed into where you are now. Enormous dangers in dismantling without the ability of being able to reform it into one integral whole. And that was what Korach did. When we talk about machlokes, yes, God gave us the capacity on the second day to be able to take things apart. He developed the power of analysis. He developed the power of being able to disintegrate large bodies and see them in their little parts and sections, right down to atomic and subatomic levels. That's how far we can go in analysis. And he wanted us to be able to do that, provided at all times we're maintaining the integrity of the complete structure. And Korach lost that vision. He was willing to take the thing apart, but he didn't have the vision of being able to maintain its integrity. There's one part of the human being you can't take apart, and that's his heart. Take that out, and he stops living, and he's finished. And every organism has a part that you can't touch, because if you touch that, you destroy it. Take a human being, you're putting him under psychoanalysis, and you're breaking him down, that's all fine, but there comes a part that you can't touch, you can't play with. You've got to leave him, you've got to do it himself. If you start disintegrating that part, he dies. You destroy him. An organization, any structure, There's a part of it that you've got to identify and realize that we can't tamper with, because if we start tampering with that, we're finished. We can never restructure it. And Korach didn't realize the one thing you couldn't tamper with was Moshe. Because start tampering with Moshe and everything's finished. Moshe was the only link the people had to God. The Torah was given to Moshe, Moshe gave it to the people. If the integrity of Moshe is questioned in the negative sense, the whole chain of tradition is questioned. You can't do that without destroying the whole structure. And he wasn't questioning Moshe. He was questioning Aaron. That's really what it was. He was a Levi and he wanted Aaron's job. He didn't want Moshe's job. He was quite happy for Moshe to retain his job. But what was he questioning? The Zohar says in Bereishis, on this whole section of the day, he was questioning the right of Moshe to settle the argument. That's what he was questioning. At the end of the day, you can take a thing apart if you maintain the method, the structure, to bring it together again. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel argued vehemently with one another, and their descendants carried on for generations. But there was a way to resolve it. We had such a thing as halacha. The community was never thrown into disarray. We knew what to do. There are ways to resolve it. It's dynamic. Both parties play a part in the resolution. When two litigants come to court, when two litigants come to Beis Din, and each present their case, and they present their case forcefully and antagonistically, that's okay because they're presenting their case in front of a court of law. They've created the system to maintain the integrity. The system is going to listen to both sides and is going to find the middle line, or is going to decide which is right. So the dynamics of the argument creates integrity. It doesn't destroy integrity. You need them to argue their case in order to come out with a clear decision. The court of law needs to hear the argument in all its passion, in all its vehemence. The court of law will not tell them to tone down and please be polite. It will let them, the Beis Din will let them say it all out. They want to hear everything. And then they can formulate their opinion. And they're free to do so because they're doing it in a court of law. Korach didn't precede his machlokes with the system to keep it intact. He didn't say, look, I have a problem with Aaron. Let's decide now who'll sort it out, and then we'll argue. That he didn't do. That's the difference between Shammai and Hillel. If a person says, I have an argument and I want it resolved before I express the argument, let's decide on the process of resolution. That's no problem. Argue what you want, question what you want, do what you want. Because you've designed a means of maintaining integrity. But if you express your reservations, if you express your doubts, if you express your questioning, before providing a forum for resolution, you're going to destroy it without being able to put it together again. That's what this country is trying to do at the moment. That's quite exciting to watch. To create a structure that will allow the process to develop without tearing the country apart. And quite a lot of progress has been made. One mustn't just see the negative, and the press tries to mock it a little bit. But it's not something funny at all. It's something very serious what's happening. That a country that was so divided has actually created a structure in which they can argue out matters in the hope that that structure will be able to come up with something that more or less resolves the differences. Whether they do or they don't, we've yet to see. But they've gone about it the right way. They made the structure first. We're not going to argue until we've decided on a structure in which we can argue. That was the point that was missing with Korach. And with that understanding, we can see the other fellows as well, the other three wicked people. They're all cases where there is an insensitivity to an integral whole. A person who is violent against himself, who takes a knife and is about to stab himself, even if he's not going to kill himself, what do? We stop him and we call a psychiatrist. It's absurd, it's insane. And even if he just raises his hand in violence against himself, we get worried about him. It's an unnatural thing to do. It's an indication of something seriously wrong. We have to be able to perceive that one of the relationships we're involved in is a one-to-one relationship with every member of the community. And that we're part of one, that there is an integrity. And we dare not do something aggressive before we've created the structure to maintain the integrity. You want to argue with him? We've got to create an environment in which that argument can take place without destroying the relationship. That's okay. You want to argue? That's fine. You have a bone to pick with him? That's fine. But create an environment in which that can be done. To raise your hand in passionate aggression is an indication that you're willing to express your aggression before you've created a system to maintain or to contain that aggression in a way that won't damage the integrity. What about the loyve veinu mishalim? Same question. Person's borrowed money. He's created a relationship. It's a business relationship of creditor to debtor. It's a relationship that he's entered into. That not feeling uncomfortable with that indebtedness is a denial of the existence of the relationship. Carries on as if nothing happens, as if there isn't a relationship. Just as the first person who raises his hand in anger acts as if there's no relationship between me and him, as if he's a dog. I'll hit him, that's all. He's part of you, he's not a dog. You have a relationship with him, you can't hit him. So it is a creditor and a debtor, you can't ignore your debt, you have a relationship with him. And an inability to be sensitive to that relationship is what makes him a rosho, a man worthy of condemnation. And the third one is a person who is in the presence of somebody greater than him and doesn't feel like it. That's also a relationship. When you're in the presence of greatness, and most of you are unfortunately at a disadvantage because you've never been in the presence of greatness. I'm very thankful of the opportunities I've had to be in the presence of greatness. And whether communication is taking place or isn't taking place, just being in the presence of greatness, there is a flow, there is a dynamic. You're aware of the fact that you're being filled. You're actually being filled. Rav Meir Soloveitchik and I were talking on the last trip that I had to Israel. I don't remember quite how the conversation came up, but we were talking about how people never appreciate what they've got. It was a much deeper conversation than that. This was the tail end of it. When he talked about the fact that a student never appreciates the opportunities that he has while he's in the presence of his Rebbe. And it's just, that's life. There's nothing you can do about it. That's how it is. Until he has it no more, then he realizes it. And he says, Rabbi Issa Zalman told him how when Rabbi Issa Zalman was in Valozhin, Rabbi Chaim Valozhin said he was going to start learning Kodshim, because the yeshiva had got up to Kodshim. It was a yeshiva where they used to learn Kesedah, starting in Brochus, and they used to go in Masechta by Masechta, and they got to Kodshim, which is a part that not everybody was ready to study. And Rabbi Chaim Valozhin decided, there was a whole debate, should they leave Kodshim alone and start again, or should they carry on with Kodshim, and whoever can manage will manage. So they decided to split the yeshiva in two. This was again a case of splitting. So those who were capable would learn Kodshim, and those who weren't would start at the beginning again and work through. And a message was sent from Reb Chaim Soloveitchik to, that's now Reb Meir's grandfather, to Reb Issa Zalman, saying, I want you to attend the Kodshim. I'm going to give the shiurim on Kodshim, and I want you to attend. And Reb Issa Zalman said, no, I'm not up to it, I'm not ready for it, and a second message came, I want you to attend, and a third message, and he didn't. He refused, he felt he wasn't ready for it, and he would stay in the other group. And Reb Meir told me how Rabbi Sazalman told him with tears running down his face, just think of it, he said. I had the opportunity to learn Kodshim with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. I was invited 3 times. I turned it down. Can you figure that? There's just no way, you know, we think, ooh, if I had the opportunity to learn with Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, would I jump at it? We don't do it. You can be learning with Moshe Rabbeinu and you wouldn't appreciate it. One of the ex-South Africans from my community who I spoke to in Israel said to me, it's the most tragic thing to go to the shiurim of great, great people. And you find 6 people at the shiur, 7 people at the shiur, 10 people is already a crowd. People don't realize what they've got. And I've given you the example so many times. Everybody quotes Chaim Shmulevitz nowadays. Chaim Shmulevitz. And everybody's got his book, and everybody's quoting his Sefer, and it's been translated into English, and everybody's talking about it all the time. Everybody knows the Sefer already. I was in Reb Chaim Shmulevitz Yeshiva, and I used to go on Friday night to hear him teach Chumash, and there were 4 of us there in Yerushalayim, sometimes 6. Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, people had the opportunity to go and study with him, not to read his Sefer, to study with him. People didn't take the opportunity. When you're in the presence of greatness, it doesn't matter whether he's teaching you or he's not teaching you. Just to see it, just to be there, you're being influenced by it. And one needs to be sensitive. And the man who's not sensitive to that dynamic, to the fact that there is a relationship, and his meis panov, he has an arrogance which causes him not to feel shame, not to feel small in the presence of greatness, that's another rosha. That's another wicked person. Those are the 4 wicked people. People who are insensitive to the existence of a relationship. In the first 3 cases, it's a relationship with another individual. In the 4th case, it's a relationship with a community. And that's a second revision. The first departing that I'd made this evening was in redefining machlokes, not just as dividing something which ought not to be divided. So the first thing I've said, which is different to what I've said before, is that dividing things even that ought to be divided are sometimes positive and sometimes negative. Machlokes is dividing something into its constituent parts, but being able to maintain the integrity of the whole at the same time. Then it's a positive machlokes. Dividing something even into its constituent parts, if you're unable to rebuild it and to maintain its integrity, that's negative machlokes. And the second thing that I'm revising is that I used to often say that there's no such thing as an organization, as a system, as a community. It's a group of individuals, and all that's important is the individuals. That isn't so. A community, a system, an organization, a business, a state, a nation, has a dynamic and a persona that is bigger than the sum of all its parts. It has a life of its own. It has a meaning of its own. It has a purpose of its own. It has a dynamic of its own. Over and above, that doesn't mean that the constituent individuals are not vitally important in their own personal rights. Of course they are. But in addition to those own rights, there is such a thing as a yeshiva, as a kollel, as a beis hamedrash, as a shul, as a community, as a country, as an organization or a system. There is such a thing, and that's what Korach missed. It's not just a bunch of individuals. And you need to be careful when you're treating the whole, the system, the organization, the community, that you're treating it with an understanding of the dynamic of its integrity. And we need to appreciate that this was not just one community. This was the whole community of Israel that was there at that time. So it was already broken up into many constituent parts. They had their equivalents of the Hasidim and the Misnagdim and this type and that type. They were all different shuls and all different rabbonim, each with their own style of education. It was a community of over 2 million people. Of course they had sub-communities within that. That wasn't the problem. That wasn't the difficulty. That was in order. Because there was the maintenance of an integrity of the entire system. And so that is, we too need to realize the importance of recognizing the constituent parts. That's fine, we've got all our different parts in Judaism, that's fine, no difficulty. But there is an integral whole that we have to be able to maintain in perspective. And that the Medrash, in its definition of Rishoyim, which we're translating as those people whose persons are worthy of condemnation, not just their actions, are defined as four different cases of people who are unaware and insensitive to the existence of an integral relationship, either between themselves and other individuals, or between themselves and a wider community. All of these relationships are not natural relationships. It's not parent-child relationships. It's not familial relationships, because those are experienced by non-human beings too. All of these four relationships are relationships which only a human being creates, and only a human being can be sensitive to. The relationship of one man to his friend, the relationship of a creditor to a debtor, a business relationship that is, the relationship of an ordinary person to a great person, and the relationship, the very special and precious relationship of the individual to the community as a whole. Thank you, Nadine.